Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
First of all, thanks everybody for attending. We obviously enjoy sharing our journey with everybody, and we hope to be able to answer any questions that you've got today. I'm Carl Cavers, CEO. David Wilton, CFO. We'll be splitting the presentation. Of those eight messages, there are four key messages or four key elements that we'd like to emphasise, which in really emphasise the strategic push that we've had in the business. First of all, the acquisition of Redkite Games, which has been very successful for us. We're in the process of relocating those guys to new premises in Leeds. We're seeing lots of opportunity to grow that business further. And we're very excited about the prospects of helping them do that. We also opened a studio in Leamington Spa, which is focused on mobile. Again, great traction for us, hitting our headcount targets, very successful onboarding of all the team. And again, great acceleration in terms of growth. Bottom left, the announcement of work with 2K. We're often constrained by confidentiality, so it's nice to be able to announce some good news sometimes. And we're working with 2K, both Redkite Studio and the Sumo Sheffield Studio. And then the final point that I'm going to pick on of the eight is the two own IP titles. So we've recently announced Pass the Punch, which is our own IP title, which we are currently working with a third-party publisher on to release based on optimum timing, but the game will actually be finished in development in November. And we've also got Dear Esther iOS, which uses the franchise that we acquired from the Chinese Room, brings it to mobile, and we're seeing a lot of interest in that, and we'll be releasing that in the fourth quarter. The final point that I want to pick up on is the appointment of Ian Livingston as chairman. Just for the record, I want to thank Ken for his input over the last 5 years. He's been great for us in terms of structuring the business, the governance and the controls. But we feel that we wanted to take more of an industry focus. There's a massive market opportunity in our space. There is nobody more experienced in our market than Ian. He's been a tremendous asset to us over the last 5 years, and having more of his strategic input and more of his involvement in the direction of the business will be a really positive thing for us. So right now, I'm going to hand you over to David, who will take you through some of the detailed financials.
Morning, everyone. Very good to see you. I'm now going to drone on for some time about IFRS 15 and IFRS 16, which I know you all enjoyed the former last year. Good news is this year I've got another one to talk about. So what I'm going to do is run you through the numbers. It's an interesting set of numbers. The key thing that I would say about them is that we are exactly where we expected to be, and we continue to be where we expect to be, if that makes sense. So it's reassuring from my point of view. I'm still relatively new to the business. I'm enjoying being here. We're keen to develop the reputation that we talked about last time we met of under-promising and over-delivering on a long-term basis. So on page three of the deck, financial highlights. So revenue just under 21 million. I will talk about the H1, H2 weighting to the extent I can. In a slide or two's time. So just hold the thought for the moment of 20 million in revenue. Adjusted gross profits, 9.8 million, and adjusted gross margin, 46.3%. The adjusted gross margin, if you remember, the key thing there is we take out royalties. Now, I've talked in the past about being around the 44% as being kind of normal. Now, that guidance remains valid, and where we are around the 44%, plus or minus, whatever, is really driven by the project mix and which particular contracts we're working on. And one thing we're keen to do in this presentation is give you as much flavour as we can, subject to confidentiality, about the projects that we're working on. Utilization, we now present this on a group basis, so we include both India and Atom Hawk, and the figure for the half year is 94.8%, which is almost identical to the full year figure for last year, and the half year last year was 93%. Adjusted EBITDA, which I'll analyse in a slide or two's time, 5.2 million. Cash flow, the good news is it hasn't got a bracket around it. I wasn't planning for it to have a bracket around it, and it hasn't got a bracket around it. I'll talk you through the cash flow. It's a big thing for us, both in the half year, but also through August, July and August, and indeed subsequently. Net cash at the end of June, 4.3 million. You'll have seen in the announcement, we had 8.9 million in the bank at the 31st of August. So I'll give you some context around that. Contracted, near-contracted development fees, we don't normally quote them at this time of year, so normally that's a figure we publicise in April when we're into the relevant accounting period. Just keen to give a flavour of where we are. 94.6% for this year, so it's pretty much in the bag, and 41% for next year. Now, it's interesting, I've already been asked a whole load of times what was the equivalent figure last year. The answer is we didn't do the exercise of scrubbing it up, but I would suspect it will be lower, but I can't validate that or verify it to a legal standard. Going over the page, what I used to call a profit and loss account, just to give you the highlights. So revenue I talked about, just over 20 million for the year. Now, if you look at any of your high quality research, you'll see that the revenue figures for the full year are probably around 50 million. In your notes. So that suggests by my feat of mathematics that there's a 30 million revenue target for H2. How do we move from 20 to 30? The biggest element is what I would call in a sort of financial world productive capacity. But what that means is our very highly valued and skilled team members. And I don't like to refer to them as productive capacity really. So basically between H1 and H2, the average number of billable fee earning people we have will go up by 130 or so, give or take. Now, that's a big increase, and you see the headcount numbers which are increasing through the year. We are, and we have always planned to increase the number of contractors we're using in the business. So the contractor headcount goes up by 50, broadly, from H1 to H2. So in round terms, 130 extra heads we have. 80 of those are our own people and 50 are our contractors. Now, stepping back a stage, you'll probably remember the milestone bar chart that I've shown on virtually every presentation I've ever given. That shows a bell curve of resourcing you put into a project. And what you have is the project resources up to a peak and then it tails off as you come towards delivery. Now, if you think we signed up four big projects back end of last year, so we had four projects which, you know, within a bit of give and take, we're showing that profile. So we always expected the first half of this year to be on the lower part of that curve. And by definition, the latter part of this year then is at the higher part of that curve. So we knew we needed more productive capacity. And we've talked about the software we use to manage our people and resourcing. And the good news is it works. So we are resourcing up to meet the demand we need. Now, if you work out the numbers, I would say probably 60 to 70% of the delta between H1 and H2 is accounted for on that basis. So what's the rest of it? Part of it is own IP. So we've invested, or we spent money on our own IP. So that's people working on our own games. We're not working for clients. It's great, doing good work, but we don't get a margin on their work until we actually start selling the game. So we're carrying about 800,000 of WIP at the end of June, most of which was built up during the first half. That probably equates to somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million of revenue that we would have got if we'd used those people for external work. And the effect is compounded by the fact that the revenue starts to come in H2. So we have the cost in H1. There is more cost in H2, but less, and then you get more revenue. And the other delta is royalties. The royalties were always back-ended in this year, simply because they are back-ended in this year. There's no particular reason to that other than the timing of the games that they relate to being released. I have taken the view that the royalties will probably be a little lower than we were expecting. But I am, just to be absolutely clear, happy with the consensus guidance on the profit line. So we are getting the same answer by a different route. Now, the reason for the delta in royalties is twofold. Firstly, I've decided to stop adjusting for IFRS 15 because I can't carry on doing that. And so, and this is a good time to change. The adjustments would not be particularly material. So I'm now assuming all my numbers are after applying IFRS 15. The slight downside to that is there was 250,000 of revenue, of royalty revenue, which I adjusted out last year, and the assumption I'd adjust it back in this year. But because I've changed the way I'm doing the numbers, that adjustment back in doesn't happen. So I've given away, from a numerical point of view, but not a real point of view, that royalty. And also we've tuned down the royalties a little bit just for timing generally. So that's the summary of where I see, you know, the revenue bridge between H1 and H2. The rest of the P&L, I think, is pretty straightforward. There's nothing I'll pick out of that, other than perhaps looking at adjusted EBITDA margin, a whisker over 25%. Always keen to keep that above 25% if we can. And clearly there's an impact of the weighting of H1 versus H2, and I would expect in H2 for that margin to be going up. If I go over the page, revenue and gross profit, this is really to highlight the fact that I'm no longer making all these adjustments that I was making. So the first two adjustments, customer revenue included within finance income and accrued royalty, those are history. So they're there to show comparability, and I'm not making equivalent adjustments now. The one adjustment we will continue to make is actually around the co-funded games. If you remember at the full year, I talked about the black and white world where you had contracts you worked on for customers and projects you worked on entirely for ourselves. But the hybrid in between, where we co-fund a game, is problematic, and the accounting rules don't let me carry the cost where I'm getting the majority of the cost paid by the client. That was £500,000 in H1. It was £200,000 in H2 last year. And it will be obviously a bigger number in the year as a whole going forward. EBITDA, a non-statutory measure, of course. How do we get there? There are, sadly, still quite a few adjustments getting there. Hopefully they're straightforward. Amortization, we are now through the process of the accelerated amortization I put through just after the IPO. So it's just normal amortization. Depreciation, I'll talk about that a bit more in a couple of slides. Share-based payments, we talked about that before. There is a prior year adjustment because we've decided, following a change in our REMCO advisors, to accrue for the employer's NI on share-based payments. I mean, it's crashingly dull, it's non-cash, but it's the advice we're now getting. So we have restated the numbers for that adjustment. We're not adjusting for customer revenue or accrued royalties. We have got the co-funded game expense, which I've talked about. IFRS 16, clearly a joy for us all. One of my team has a great summary of IFRS 16. He says it fixes the balance sheet and breaks the P&L, which I think is actually a very good summary, because what it's done is it's taken our leases and it's made them into fixed assets. So we have right of use asset, we have a liability that goes with it, and over a full year, based on our current portfolio of studios, it takes £1 million out of rent and puts it into depreciation. So it's, you know, great, my EBITDA's gone up by £1 million. It hasn't really. So I've taken it out in getting to this calculation. Then exceptional items, mainly transaction fees and you know, one-off advisor cost. Going over the page to the balance sheet. Try and keep the balance sheet really simple and straightforward. Goodwill and intangibles. I think you probably all know I'm a fan of not having goodwill and intangibles, but clearly we have to. That mainly reflects Red Kite, which we took on and clearly has very little in the way of assets. Fixed assets, PPE as it is here, that the delta there is mainly the IFRS 16 addition of the leases, and also some CapEx, and I'll talk about CapEx later on. Working capital, I'm going to go into in a bit more detail, so just park that for the moment. Corporation tax and then the IFRS 16 lease liability. Going over the page to trade and other receivables, I'm quite keen to be pretty analytical about this and give you visibility of where we are. When I arrived pre-IPO, we signed up the contract with, which I think everyone knows is the IO contract. where we did the work and we were going to get paid after the game had been launched. Now, that is enigmatically referred to here as contract one. And in December, I was standing in a room just down the road from here talking about 7.8 million of receivables on that. And what I said to anyone who'd listen is that will unwind in 2019, probably, well, effectively in H2 2019. Now, the upshot is we had 2.5 million of that 7.8 million in H1. We've had 3.5 million in early H2, and the rest of it is not due yet. So that contract is doing exactly what I expected it to do and behaving in accordance with its terms. So if you look at the numbers here, the 11.8 million of trade debtors includes 3.5 million on that contract, which was there at the 30th of June and was paid, I think it was in the first week of July. So overall, where we are with receivables, the number went up between December and June. If I focus on the 11.1 million of trade debtors, 10.4 of that 11.1 was current, so less than 30 days old, and I have no overdue debt then or now. So what I then do is, if I go over the page, net working capital, we had a phenomenally strong first 10 days of July. I'm quite pleased. We're not a highly leveraged private equity backed business with a 30th of June covenant. Yeah, we had 10 million of cash come in the first 10 working days of July. And overall, we had 14 million come in during the course of July as a whole. So we've had very strong cash flow, and it's as expected. It's in line with the milestone due dates. So what I've done is I've presented a snapshot of August, the end of August, where we are. Net working capital at 9 million, having been at 14.7 2 months earlier, and cash at 8.9 million. Now, some of you will go away and try and work out the delta between June and August. I have paid some tax, and I have paid some capex, and I've had two payrolls go out. So overall, the cash position is strong and exactly as we expect. And I expect to continue to generate cash through the rest of this year. The cash flow statement, not much to say about that. It reflects pretty much what we talked about before. I'll talk about the full year outlook for capex and tax on the next slide. So guidance and updates. I like to try and give you as much guidance as I can and by way of an update on what's happening through the rest of the year. Clearly, there are limits to what I can say. So tax, forecasting tax in our business is quite a challenge. There's a lot of deferred tax movements. So basically, the tax position is driven by the launch date of games and also by the share-based payments. There's also complications around the tax treatment of the VGTR as an income. Where does that leave us? I would say that having guided you the people in this room to applying a full tax charge year on year, I'm probably happy to be a percentage point below that. We seem to be in a position where we are going to pay less than a full tax charge year on year. But I do want to keep finessing that forecasting. So I'm reluctant to go much below that, although clearly I will aspire to do so. One of the reasons I'm talking about tax is that for me, this is a great day. This is the first time I've reported a positive profit before tax on a public company. That's probably a reflection of where I spent the dark days of the recession. So I'm now conscious, and we always expected, that we need to start moving from EBITDA being our key measure down to earnings per share. And the southern part of the P&L is somewhere where we need to be a bit more forensic, I think. So the tax charge is going to matter. And as I say, I would dial it down a little. On capex, there's also an impact on the earnings per share and taking you down from EBITDA. So depreciation is clearly driven by the amount we spend on the capital expenditure. We now have 9 locations and we have over 700 people. The capex we spend on the business is going to be driven by studios and people. So the guidance that I gave at the IPO is now looking out of date. I expect this year for us to be spending around 4.5 million of capex, and next year possibly 5 million. That's above what I would call a normal level for the size of the business it is now. And the reason for that is that this year we're relocating Red Kite from Huddersfield to Leeds. We're also investing in an audio studio on a new leasehold unit in Sheffield. And next year, we're moving two of the Newcastle studios to a new location. So that's Atom Hawk and Sumo in Newcastle. I'd like to be getting to a point where it's 4 million for this size of business, but I'm pretty sure by the end of next, or probably by the end of this year or next year, we're going to be significantly bigger than we are now. So there will be an element of CapEx going up in line with the growth in the business. That has an effect on depreciation. So the some of you have different numbers going forward for depreciation, but I suspect we need to be dialing that up by probably 500,000 or so in 20 and 21. Otherwise, on this page, working capital, I've hopefully given you as much detail as you need. Red Kite Games going well, exactly as we want it to be doing. Very happy with it. Foreign currency, we are earning, we talk about $7 million of revenue in US dollars. We are now fully hedged, not into gambling on the exchange markets, particularly in the current world. So we are fully hedged on that. That does have an impact on our interest costs because we do have the mark to market going through that line. And clearly that can go up as well as down. IFRS 16 talked about, there's a slide in the back if anyone wants to go into more forensic detail. And then FY19, in case you hadn't noticed, we have quite a significant second half weighting, which hopefully I've explained how that works. Going over the page, client concentration. Very difficult to talk about this. What I've done, and this slide may take a bit of explaining. So if you look at FY17, the top three clients were 58% of our revenue. Client A was the first biggest, client B the second, and client C the third. If you look at FY20, the order had changed. Whoever was third the year before became first. Who was first the year before became second, and a new entrant came in at number three. I think you can probably work out how it works going forward. What I'm keen to show is that the top three are not always the same people, they're not always in the same order, and furthermore, the number of projects they're working on varies. Now, we do multiple projects for the same clients, Carl always says that the next best new client is the client we already have, and that is actually very much how we operate. So the headline figure, top three clients in the first half of this year, 65%. It's actually eight projects compared to last year for the full year, six projects being 53%. I do think long-term the trend will reduce, but I do reserve the right for it to go up at any particular time, particularly for a half year, which clearly is more focused. Going over the page, aside from client concentration, video games tax relief is always a point to discuss. There's not a lot to say about it. It's there, it gets bigger as we get bigger. We include it within direct costs, as we always have done. It appears to have broad political support. The politicians seem to have something else to talk about at the moment, so they're not focused on this. But certainly everything we've seen and heard suggests that it is still very effective for HMRC. The only issue we have with it is that members of the team at HMRC who deal with it are being redeployed onto Brexit. So we are seeing a bit of a delay in the process of getting the payments, but there is no change in behaviour. So things aren't being questioned anymore. There's no sort of more difficulty in getting the receipts from them. That's my last slide. So I'll now pass back to Carl to talk you through the business itself.
Okay, so just to give you all a bit of a flavour and an update on what we've been doing over the last 6 months. We talk here about some of the games that we've released or clients that have been announced. We released Crackdown earlier in this year for Microsoft. Team Sonic Racing, which was released in May. And then at the very back end of last year, we released Hitman. All titles have been very successful in terms of the way they've been received. We've been credited very well for our involvement with those titles, and we're very pleased with the success that they've shown to date. In terms of announcing new client relationships, we announced Focus Home Interactive. I think I actually did that on the morning of the full year results for 18 earlier this year. But that relationship's going really well. It's a very strong relationship. It's with our Newcastle studio, which we opened in January 2018. Great new relationship for those guys. We recently announced that we're working with 2K Games, part of Take-Two. We're working with those in different facilities. We're working with the teams at Take-Two, both in Sheffield and at Red Kite. And then also with Curve Digital, we continue to work with those guys as a publisher and they're currently working with our Nottingham studio. Our strategic partners pretty much are consistent. We try and onboard new strategic partners. Apple are there. You know, they are relatively new, but the relationship is very good. We're obviously working on our own IP for Apple, which is quite a unique position when they're funding the development. But we're very pleased with the direction and the way that relationship is heading. So just turning over the page, and David alluded to this in his slide when he talked about customer concentration. One of the challenges we have is client confidentiality. And we'd love to tell you more about what we're doing in the business. It's one of the reasons we love open days, and we try and lift the hood a little bit, at least on our own technology, so you can see the depth of what we're doing and what we're experiencing. But in actual fact, we've got 18 projects in development across the Sumo Digital Studios, of which you can see four green boxes here. They're the only ones we can talk about. So it, you know, there's a lot more happening at Sumo Digital than you guys often see. What we've tried to do here is give it a bit of a flavour for the type of work and activity that's happening in each studio. So Sheffield, for example, you can see that we're developing Spider for Apple, but you can also see that they've got three new IPs in development. They've also got a franchise game in development, and they're also doing some co-development. So it gives you a mix, a flavour of the mix of the type of work that we're doing within the various studios. Again, you know, the projects we work on are very long term. So we're not sure when these things are going to get announced. Sometimes it's several years. But what we will try to do is obviously surface as much information as we can so that you guys have some visibility of the depth and the style of projects we have within all the different studios. So over time, this should hopefully give you a good map of how the journey is going. Also like to highlight Atom Hawk, which is the other division, the very small division that we have. You know, they represent around 7% of our overall revenue, but they do perform a great function in terms of their input into both game development projects at Sumo Digital and their own client base. So they're currently working with approximately 18 different projects as well, of which only two are announced. But that's split across both their studios in Newcastle and Vancouver. So moving on to a summary of our Capital Markets Day, and I think most of the people in this room actually attended it, and we will be looking to do another one next year. We felt it was really successful, and we feel everybody that attended got something out of it as well. The great thing about it is it allowed us to demonstrate the depth of involvement we have in projects. You know, we are not just hiring out bodies that contribute to other people's projects. We have our own technology, very rich and deep technology that helps facilitate the delivery of the games. You know, we're fully developing the game design and game balancing for the games that we're working on, and obviously doing all the art implementation. So again, demonstrating that we do everything from the original concept right the way to final delivery of the Gold Master, and we're responsible for every different element of that when we're doing the full life cycle of development. And what we also gave you then was how we control that within our game development framework and the game development process. Now, it is a very controlled environment. The milestone deliveries that we deliver every 4 to 6 weeks help us have consistency of delivery. It ensures that we don't go off piste, ensures that the client is happy with the project as we go through development. There is no risk of getting to the end of a project and finding that you know, that we're miles apart, because we've worked on this project together collaboratively and through many, many deliveries on that journey. In terms of gross margin, David talked about the strength of gross margin we currently have. First of all, that is underpinned by our strong demand. I talked in April about the size of our immediately addressable pipeline and our overall pipeline. It's still a similar size. Our current immediately addressable pipeline sits at around 50 million sterling, which is split across 11 different opportunities we're actively pursuing. We obviously won't take on all that work. We don't have the capacity to do that. But it gives you an idea of the opportunity that is out there at the moment. Our overall pipeline is still sitting at just over 300 million pounds sterling. Huge amount of opportunities in the market. And that's really within the you know, the usual client base that we work with. We do anticipate to see further opportunities from new markets as we try and onboard new clients, onboard new opportunities as well. Core tech, again, the demonstration that we did at the Capital Markets Day, I think brought to life the fact that we are reliable at delivery, but what we are is also very efficient, because we reuse a lot of the aspects of code that we own. We own all the underlying technology. It allows us to both be reliable in terms of delivery, but also it provides a level of efficiency that a lot of developers can't achieve, because we reinvest in what we're doing, and we'll continue to reinvest in core technology, especially as new platforms come online. You know, we've talked about Apple Arcade, there's Google Stadia as well, and I'm sure there'll be others coming to market at some point in the future as well. And then finally, cost structure. Being based in the UK is actually an advantage, especially at the minute with the weak pound. But also we've got India, and India, you know, is roughly 128 people, most of them directs, contributing to live projects back in the UK. It's not a throw over the wall outsourcing shop. So, you know, it's treated as equal to the UK, and we don't charge out a different rate for India. And I think that's an important component to keep in your mind as you try and form an opinion for the value of the business. Moving over the page to royalties. Right, royalties remain an important element of our contracts, and it will always be an important component. However, as I've always said, we take a very prudent view on royalties, and we will always take a prudent view based on the information that we receive from our publishing partners. It is the one bit of revenue that is outside of our control in terms of when the timing is, when it's coming in. But equally, we are confident that the projects that we have an entitlement to royalty on, we will see the royalties start trickling through to the bottom line. And the great thing is, it just does trickle through to the bottom line. Our own IP. So now we have a back catalogue, which we didn't used to have. So we've got Snake Pass, which we released in 2017, and it's still selling. And Dear Esther, which we acquired from the Chinese Room, again, is still selling. What we've done is a third-party publishing deal. So we have an arrangement with a publisher. It's Curve Digital. And they're pushing the sales. And what we are seeing with the publishing knowledge that they have, they're able to leverage sales that we could not achieve, trying to self-publish those titles at this phase of the life cycle. And it's you know, it's proving to be a great success in terms of the relationship and the success of the sales of those titles. So that's great, because we just continue to get revenue for things we've already invested in. You know, we're not spending any more money on these things, and we continue to receive revenue that's flowing through to the bottom line again. We've also announced two new titles that we're bringing to market. The first one is Pass the Punch, and we will be partnering with a third-party publisher to bring that to market. We feel that is the best opportunity to maximise the sales opportunity that is out there. And then Dear Esther on iOS. So leveraging the strength of that IP and the power of the mobile device. Now, the experience fits that device beautifully. And we're going to release that in Q4 this year. And then finally, Spider and Little Orpheus, which are our own IP. We are developing them initially exclusively for the Apple Arcade platform, but we will retain ownership of that IP, and we'll be able to exploit those IPs on other platforms at some point in the future. In addition to that, we also have unannounced own IP games in development to ensure we've got the right pipeline for next year as well. Boosting Sumo's creativity. An interesting, probably vague title, but what we wanted to highlight is the further investment that we continue to make in our concept and prototyping team. Now, we've had a concepting team for several years. It's been very successful in initiating ideas and leveraging those ideas either with RFPs from clients or helping us launch new IP. But it is a very slow process when a concept team can only visualize its ideas through static images. What we felt we needed to do was, again, leveraging the technology that we already have, was to put in a prototyping team so that we can actually get early stage prototypes and demos into our clients' hands and to prospective end users as well. So we are investing more in our prototyping team. I think we'll start to see some good success from that going forward. We're certainly excited by the fact that we'll be able to demonstrate early stage prototypes much more effectively than we have been able to date. So we can only see that underpinning the success that we've had. And then finally, Ian Livingston being on board. Now, Ian's been on board for 5 years, and he was instrumental in us setting up game jams, instrumental in us actually having the belief to start developing our own IP. And he's very much involved with what we call our IPCC, which is our Intellectual Property Creation Committee, which is a bit of a mouthful and it's not very creative. But essentially, what that committee does is gate the whole process for our own ideas. So you don't get carried away in believing that we've got a great idea. It's not a gated process. We just bring it to market. There is a fully gated process. That gated process can even involve getting third-party publishers in to look at the confidence they would have in bringing a product to market before we decide whether we want to invest further in that game and start developing it ourselves. We do have aspirations to do more of our own IP. In a way, we are a victim of our own success because as we get more work in from our clients and our core business, we tend to allocate our resources as a priority to those projects. So we do feel that we need to get more disciplined in ensuring that we're allocating resources to our own IP equally on the same basis and looking to bring more of our own IP to market over the next couple of years. So just a little bit on operations, and we've changed the standard map showing where the locations are around the world to actually showing that how we're starting to think about our studios and the branding of those studios. And we are going through a branding exercise at the moment. So we have what we call our city studios, which are all Sumo-based, based in different locations. And we have our brand studios. Generally, the brand studios that are the businesses that we've acquired. And we bought them for more than just capacity. You know, we bought them because they have some level of value, either in IP or expertise. Or even technology, and we wanted to retain that value without diluting it. So we're maintaining those brands within the way we sell those services. We opened our Leamington office, as I've already mentioned, earlier this year, which has become the Sumo Leamington. It is mobile focused. We have done mobile games before, but what this studio brings is a specific expertise around free-to-play. It doesn't mean we're going to be doing free-to-play games ourselves, but it does give us the ability to be able to help service some of our clients and bring on new clients that want the skills and expertise to help them deliver free-to-play games to market. And then, as we've already touched on with Redkite, being a great success in terms of an acquisition earlier this year, fully on board and integrated already. And we are looking to relocate those into the Leeds offices. It's been a great success. And we've been inundated with applicants for new roles there. It's been frustrating because in the current office in Huddersfield, they are maxed out. So the sooner we can get them into the new premises, the better. As far as extending our operations go, we will look to open new locations, what we call city studios, through organic growth. There are areas in the UK and abroad that we could operate from that would give us a further attraction to strong talent pools. And we'll also continue to look at bolt-on acquisitions such as the Redkite and the Chinese Room. And as David mentioned it in the past, we do have an appetite to do more significant deals, and we'd like to bring on a bigger operation to sit alongside Sumo Digital that can complement the service offering that we currently have. Moving on to headcount, recruitment and utilisation. We're extremely pleased with the progress we've made on talent acquisition. over the first half of this year. If you remember, for those that, that were at the presentation in April, you know, we did suffer from a higher level of attrition towards the back end of last year than we would normally experience. And it was a mix of several different factors. The two key factors were, first of all, onboarding new projects and giving people the visibility of what they were going to be working on next. And we had particular sensitivity at that time around the Apple contracts, created a little bit of volatility in terms of people not having full visibility of what they were moving on. That had an impact on attrition. And also we went through a job leveling exercise as well, and that created some unrest among some individuals that again impacted on our attrition. But I'm very pleased to say that year to date, since we've settled down on the new contracts, people have full visibility of what they're working on, attrition's, you know, gone back to a very low rate. In the UK, 6.4% year to date, and I'm extremely pleased with the India attrition, which is only 8.3% year to date, which is extremely low for an Indian operation. And we're benefiting from that. That's helping us accelerate our headcount growth. You know, we're not fighting attrition to bring in new talent. We've also brought in a new talent acquisition manager who's the most energetic person I've ever met when it comes to recruitment. He absolutely loves being involved in the video game industry, and he's had a tremendously positive impact on our ability to attract talent as well, and the way we're going about that. So we see that continuing. We do see the strength of talent attraction continuing through the back half of this year as well. And then finally, utilisation remains high. As David mentioned, in the past, we've reported utilisation on a UK basis only. We've now standardised that across the group, and we're now reporting a group utilisation figure, which we're still very happy with. It currently achieving just shy of 95% across the group. In terms of the market, I'm sure you guys look at the market as much as I do to try and figure out what's going off and how exciting it is. But I just thought I'd highlight a few different aspects. Obviously, the growth of the market is talked about a lot. But what are those key growth drivers? We talk here about everything from esports through to consoles and Xbox. You know, we are involved at Sumo in every different aspect of those examples. You know, we've worked on esports, we have worked on VR, we have worked on mobile, but we now have a specialist mobile studio. We obviously work on console and PC. So we're able to deliver interactive content regardless of the platform and service delivery. Apple Arcade, which launched earlier this month, I think, you know, looking like it's going to be a great success. We've got two titles I've already mentioned for release, and that's helping to fuel more people playing games. You know, I'm sure it will onboard new potential players at the same time as well. And then Google Stadia. We have a project at Redkite, which is working on that platform, which is great. So again, we're addressing all the new potential market opportunities. Average age of a gamer. I think I talk about this at every presentation. Everyone always seems surprised by it. It's 34. Great disposable income. And what it's becoming more standard as well is it's part of family time. You know, you've got to forget games as being an individual experience anymore, because they're not. You go back 10 or 15 years and it was an individual experience. There weren't many connected games online. Everything's connected. Everything's social these days. So when your son or daughter goes to their bedroom and plays games and you're worried about them sitting there on their own, they're not. They're there with a crowd of friends. They're just not all in the same place. But another way to interact with family members is to play yourself. And you find a lot of parents that have played games all their life being able to play with their kids. And it's a great social experience. You know, it's not like sitting and watching TV and not talking. It is something you can interact and it's something you can do together. And I think that helps fuel the growth in terms of the demographic as well. Interesting stat here, it's referenced to the US, but 45% of gamers being female. Gaming is ubiquitous across platforms, genres, geographies. People enjoy playing games just like they enjoy other experiences like reading books or watching TV. But interactive entertainment is the thing that really seems to resonate. Tax incentives in the UK, David's already touched on. We don't see that changing. It seems to have full cross-party support still, and it gives us a great subsidy in terms of being able to bring better games to market. If anything, it's definitely a great success. DCMS recently quoted that for every pound they're investing in it, it's generating around £4 of revenue. So, it's seen by as a great success by the government as well. UK universities remain a great source of talent for us. We are also working with universities outside the UK as well now. But we're working with more universities in the UK, and we are deepening the relationships we currently have. Talent acquisition is our number one priority. It's our number one challenge, and I think it will remain so. Everybody's looking for great quality talent. Moving on to the group strategy, no big changes as you'd expect. We are still looking at organic and accelerated organic growth. Organic growth now being across 9 different studio locations though, which again helps fuel the success. Accelerated by us looking at opening other new studio locations. And then M&A. Over the last 2 years, we've completed 4 small but very high quality acquisitions. They're all fully integrated. They're all contributing very positively. We're very happy with the way that's gone, and we'll continue to do more bolt-on acquisitions. But we'll also, as I mentioned earlier, look to do something more significant in the future as well, and look to really complement the service activity of Sumo Digital. So the strategy remains consistent with what we've always said and what we're trying to achieve. Finally, in summary and outlook, the H1 results are in line, exactly in line with our expectations. Successful transition to new projects has been very pleasing, the way we've onboarded those projects, the way we've been able to move the resources across, the way we're now moving towards a more of a peak demand within those profiles, as David talked about with the bell curve. So it's all within a planned activity. More move towards our own IP on a low-risk basis. We're not talking about changing that model, but we obviously want to ensure that we do prioritise getting those products to market. It's too easy for us to just take those resources off and put them on paid-for work. The acquisition of Red Kite, as I've mentioned, we're very happy with, and the opening of the Leamington studio. I've said this every single time. This bullet point will be on everything, but investing in people and systems for future growth. David talked about CapEx. We've got 9 locations now. CapEx, is a function of the fact that we are being successful. We have to have those locations, and we have to invest in the space and the infrastructure to allow us to deliver on the opportunities that we have. Further strengthening strategic partnerships. Obviously very pleased earlier this year to be able to announce that we're working with Focus. Also very pleased more recently to announce the relationship with 2K. As I said, we've got 18 projects, major projects in development, and we can only talk about 14. So hopefully we can announce further strategic partnerships going forward. We're very confident in our prospects for the back end of this year, because we're in exactly the place that we wanted to be. And that's it from me. Thank you very much. Any questions? Patrick?
Carol, just in terms of the cash balance, you talk about sort of strengthening cash and just thinking about acquisition opportunities, where they may lie and what type of size you see out there, and sort of where the pipeline might come from Sumo's perspective. Is it competitive processes, or is it through your own network that you're finding?
It's mainly through our own network. We're trying to avoid competitive processes because we want people to work with us that want to work with us, and not because we've paid the best price, essentially. But we do have a strong pipeline. We are casting the net out wide. We're not just looking at the UK or Europe. We are going further afield. We are optimistic on that pipeline in terms of the opportunity that it could present.
Okay, and then one other question, just in terms of the outsourcing that you mentioned this year, is that likely to be an increased feature in the business going forward? I mean, what's the percentage of overall work that you'd plan to outsource over time?
So generally, we've always targeted around 10%. As a normal figure. It depends on where we are in that bell curve, though. So if we have several projects at the same sort of time in that bell curve, our subcontracting might go up. If, again, they're at the same period of the curve and it's later, that might drop off. So it just depends on the mix of projects and the timing of those projects. But I'd always like to think we do a minimum of 5%. I think we can probably go up to 15, 20% if we need to. You know, we've got that ability in terms of the contacts and relationships we have. But generally, it will stick around 10%.
Hi, Will Wallace from Numis. Can you talk about own IP effort a little bit more? And perhaps can you tell us what proportion of your available man months or person months or whatever it should be, you spent in on own IP in the first half? What do you think it'll be in the second half? And where do you aspire to? You're talking about doing more of it.
Yeah.
The pressures of that meaning that it's negative for your revenues very short term. Yep. Where do you aspire that to be medium to longer term?
So when we came to market, we'd always said we wanted to target getting 2 to 3 games to market each year. And that's still the aspiration. We did say we wouldn't get anything to market in 2018, which we didn't. We ensured that we were ready to bring products to market this year. The challenge for us is we do prioritise the core development fees, which I think is right. You know, that's our clients are important to us, those relationships are important. But what we've got to be careful of is that we're not missing the opportunity. And we need to ensure that we're carving those resources out. In terms of the allocation this year, we had more people working on own IP in H1 than we anticipate in H2. Partly because we're shifting people back onto to core development work. But we do need to ensure that going forward, that own IP is more disciplined in terms of us having those resources allocated so that we can have a more certain pipeline of delivery year on year for those projects.
Have you reduced your expected time on own IP for the second half of the year over the last few months? Has that come down at all? In other words, have you reduced what you planned to do?
No, not what we planned. No, it is as per plan at the moment.
I just wanted to ask about whether you're seeing any impact from the next-gen console transition. Are you seeing a sort of a change of mix or a slowdown in commitment to projects or larger projects as a result of, suppose publishers moving on to next-gen development?
No, not at all. And we've not seen that for several years now. If we go back to the old console transitions, when people wanted to wait until they got the right market penetration before they'd invest in developing the next game, that's changed because everything's backward compatible. So what we are seeing is people asking about the ability to move the tech onto those new platforms, which we'll obviously be able to do. But it's just becoming an extension of everything else we're working on, rather than in usurping anything we're working on, or indeed becoming a delaying factor in people making decisions.
And I had a second question just around M&A. So you've emphasised the intention to acquire the right opportunity.
Yes.
I think you implied it would sit alongside digital as well.
Yeah.
So a slightly different type of acquisition. I suppose North Edge has bought into Catalyst recently,
yes,
and you're
saw
working
that
with Curve. Yeah. Do parts of that studio sort of make sense? What would you be looking for in terms of an acquisition target?
I don't know if parts of that studio make sense or not. I know Dominic and those studios quite well. Obviously, they've got testing and publishing, and we're a game developer. So, you know, what we're looking for really is complementary activity in terms of different service lines within the game developer framework, or different clients that we don't currently work with that we'd bring in as part of that acquisition.
Hi, just a couple of questions from me. Well, one main question for me, really. On the curve, the bell curve we'd normally talk about, I just want to talk about the shape of that one sort of over the longer term. So if we think about, give it a few years, the change in the world, we're going towards a world of streaming, which might be usage-based as opposed to buying the game.
Yeah.
which might mean potentially that the price of the games come down for retail. But clearly your cost won't change. No. You know, the game is still going to be as expensive as it was back then. But you might see more paid downloadable content as years go on.
Yeah.
Therefore more royalties as years go on. Can you talk about what you think your curve could become as we move to a world where more revenue is reliant on the longer tail for your clients versus the base game?
Okay, so that's a really good question. It's one of the reasons we've opened the mobile studio, because the mobile have been doing this for a long time. So they've been looking at games as a service as an integral part of how they launch games and keep that tail going. So if you look at a mobile game, although it's on a much smaller scale, you don't have the same distribution curve generally. You have an little initiation peak ramp, and then it's pretty flat because it's all measured around statistics for daily active users, or day one users, monthly active users, etc. And there possibly is a point whereby some of the more premium experiences will go the same way. There's a huge debate in the industry at the moment about whether games will become subscription-based, whether they'll become free-to-play and engage in a different way. I don't know where that end commercial model will go ultimately. But what I do know is content is getting more sophisticated. So not only are we seeing more opportunities which offer different commercial models, but also those opportunities are bigger than themselves to be able to bring to market. So the risks that our clients are taking do seem to be bigger than the risk they were taking 10 years ago. But also the potential rewards are so much higher for them. Now, that's great, that's their market, but it's just that's not the market we're in. In terms of us delivering those services, what I particularly like about it is the stability of contracts. So we already benefit from long-term contracts because it takes several years to develop a game anyway, and I don't see that changing. What I do see changing is the ability to bring one of those games to market in a smaller way earlier and use metrics to be able to prolong the life cycle. So you may see the peak demand just drop slightly, but the tail should be a lot flatter and higher than it has been in the past.
Ross Porter from Investec. Given talent acquisition is the number one priority at the moment, what are you seeing in terms of wage inflation? And I presume you're not getting too many West Coast salary type demands just yet.
Not too many, although we have brought somebody in from the West Coast recently, haven't we?
Relocated from California to Sheffield.
Yes, that's an unusual move. He likes the rain. At general levels, we're not seeing a huge amount of wage inflation pressure. We've always built in a 5% wage inflation cost into what we do anyway, which is quite attractive in terms of the UK. Where we are seeing wage inflation pressure is at the very senior end of people, because you build teams and you build service lines around those senior people. So those people, yes, we are seeing, it is more competitive. But what we rely on is not just being the best payers in terms of remuneration, but providing the right environment, the right culture, the right projects for people to work on as well. It all contributes to the end decision. People aren't just driven about the final paycheck. They're also driven around that working environment piece, the culture piece, and particularly what projects that they can work on.
Morning, Darren Nathan from Hybridine. Clearly, morning. You've got some great relationships, brand value, etc., with publishers. I was just wondering, how important is it for you as a business to actually engage with game users and what your strategy around that is?
So that's exactly why we want to do our own IP. So you're right, most of our business is business to business, and we have great relationships. We do sometimes manage the business to consumer part for our clients, but we're not directly responsible for those elements. However, delivering our own IP gives us that ability to build our own client relationship with the end consumer, and that is something that we're keen to do.
Just further on that, if I may, are you seeing or do you see any challenge from a resource perspective, splitting between IP and work for hire in terms of how someone feels about doing that job, one or either, in the, the potential for attrition, basically. And then just one follow-up on M&A and for larger deals, in that, was that what you were saying, in that you would be looking for larger deals where they would be adding complementary sub-service lines within game development? Yes. Would that be the overarching rationale on that?
Yeah, either that or a new client base within that game development.
That'd be for bigger deals, not bolt-on deals.
Yeah, bolt-on deals we see as accelerating the growth further of their existing facilities, such as the you know, the Red Kite acquisition, which has been great for us in terms of bringing in particular skills and expertise. They bought their own contract, so it didn't actually give us any free capacity at that point in time. But what it has done is give us a very energised management team, a great brand that we can then look to accelerate growth from as we relocate them to new premises. Just on those, so on the attrition piece. So you're absolutely right. If we brought people in and said, you're going to work on project A, B or C for the rest of your life, we'd lose them. So what we have an ability to do is move people around projects. And we do move people a lot based on what their skills and experience are, because often the skills and experience can be useful for a period of time on a project, but it's not necessarily needed for the whole duration of that development of the project. And also the fact that they want to do something new. So sometimes people want to work on a big AAA experience, and it's great. You know, they're on a project for 3, 4, 5 years, and they get a great buzz out of being credited for working on a game that's got that type of recognition. But then sometimes they just want to work on something that's small and innovative. And at that point, we look to provide that opportunity through doing our own IP. And in fact, when we started the Game Jam process, which is how we ended up launching Snake Pass, which became our first own IP title, our desire wasn't just to own our own IP. It was also to provide a creative outlet for the talent that we've got to work on smaller style projects that are quite innovative without them feeling the need to leave to do that. So it gave us that ability to be able to give that offering, which we'd not had before.
Just to follow up, does that mean that you're potentially attracting the wrong type of people, in that, you know, let's say there is a lot of AAA, but they don't get, and you know, that they basically join you with a view because they want to be making games rather than actually they want to be, you know, work for hire, and then you're hiring the wrong people?
We have a very thorough onboarding process and interview process. So we're very clear with people. People don't come to us with a job without knowing what they're going to be working on or what they're doing. Most of our clients allow us through NDA, once we get to a certain stage of that interview process, to share what project that is going to be, so that people have a very clear view of what they're coming to work on.
Hi there, Peter Smiley from FinCap. Given Keyword Studios mentioned that they were extremely pleased, those were exact words, I think, in being able to recruit into their games development business, which obviously is going to probably be their largest service line. And your comments that you've found it easy to recruit, and yet there's no wage inflation. Has there been any notable change as to the source of where these people are coming from? Is there any evidence, for example, of smaller players, operators in your specific game development work for hire space suffering, and you're getting people from there?
Okay, so to answer that question then, essentially yes, there are a lot of small game developers that don't exist anymore. Mainly because they're not at the scale that they needed to be to do the work they used to do. In terms of, I didn't say it was easy. I don't think I said it was easy. I think I said I'm very pleased with the success that we're having. You know, talent acquisition is a priority and we treat it as a priority. But I think we're very fortunate in the environment that we have and the projects that we're working on to be able to share that with prospective employees. And that really attracts a lot of high quality talent. I think also people come to Sumo because it's a great culture, it's a great environment. And equally, you know, we're not just doing that in one location or two locations. We've got 9 different locations that we're growing headcount from. I think if I was trying to achieve the same headcount growth in 1 or 2 locations, we'd probably struggle. But having the different locations and fishing in the different talent pools has allowed us to grow. Now, we have a studio in Brighton, as does Keywords with Studio Gobo. We've been successful in hiring, and I'm guessing that Studio Gobo have been successful in hiring as well. And it, so it comes down to the culture and the environment and the projects that, that people want to work on. And that's up to us as a management team to ensure that we maintain that environment and we maintain the level of quality in projects that we work on to attract the right talent.
And then the second question is on client concentration. Just want to tackle it from the point of view about your observed comments on the overall pipeline being 300 million plus. And yet you said that's the usual client base. I was quite surprised by that. Is there not new clients within that? How do you explain that?
There are some new clients, but it's the general client mix, the clients that we've seen before. What we are trying to do is extend our client opportunities into new markets as well. As I've often said, our clients are predominantly North American and European based. We need to get out into other parts of the world, Asia particularly, and start looking for opportunities there. We're also starting to hear about opportunities in India, particularly in terms of that market growing and having its own publishing divisions being set up, particularly for mobile at the moment. But that will change. They will move to more PC-based, I'm sure. Whether it gets console or not, I don't know. But there are new markets opening up all the time.
Now, I understand that you've mentioned before you have a preference for working for these big clients who are dependable and tend to work with you, sticky clients. But I just want to observe there's no emergence of a trend of these existing clients kind of almost demanding that you only work for them within this business pipeline that you mentioned, hence the criticality to find a sizable complementary acquisition that gives you access to new clients that you otherwise are increasingly restricted from getting.
That's an interesting observation. I've not thought about it that way. But no, we don't get any pressures in terms of clients saying, we can't do X, Y or Z. We sometimes have various non-compete arrangements within the commercial contracts we have, as does every other developer. But we're very careful not to accept anything that would compromise our ability to grow our business.
It's a sort of a follow-on question from the last question. What happens, let's say you're running at 95% utilisation, which is fairly standard, and let's say you contracted out maybe, 15 to 20%, and then Sony come in and say to you, we've got this great game and we really want you to get involved with it. How do you react to that? What sort of timing is involved?
So generally, we ask for between 3 and 6 months notice to be able to start the initiation of spinning up a new team.
So you'd always have that with all of your major clients then? That's the sort of standard?
Absolutely. It's a standard discussion that we have in terms of that onboarding process for new projects. Thank you all very much for this morning.
Thank you. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.